Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net, joined remotely yet again by my based on a true story co-host, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com. Hello, Charlie.
Based on a true story, you must be talking about all the Avengers news and Batman news we're going to talk about. I'm excited about this episode, Hannah. Yeah, we have our first few reviews, and the first two, the two films we're going to talk about are actually both, yes, based on a true story. And then we have two documentaries, and then we're going to actually get into the sundries, the round tables. There's a category about the Grammys, which I watched last Sunday that I want to talk about, which leads me into this year's best song. Maybe we'll talk some more about Oscar noms. And there's something about Justice League and a little surprise I want to ask you about after that.
Okay. Yes, we are a round table of two.
Round table. We have convened the committee. Let us begin. And let's talk about the first based on a true story. I was not there, by the way, in 1960 when this went down to 1962.
I wasn't either, just for the record.
I was not there in London, nor was I there in Moscow. Both cities where The Courier takes place, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. Benedict Cumberbatch. I love to say that. Let me do it one more time. Benedict Cumberbatch. He
Doctor Strange.
The Courier. And he's actually playing a man called Greville Wynn, which is the most British sounding name this side of Benedict Cumberbatch. MI6 and the CIA recruit Greville, this salesman, this traveling salesman. He has contacts, he has contracts in Eastern Europe, and they say, you know what? It's easy for you to go over to Moscow for us. There's a source there. We need you to talk to him, and the KGB will never look at you. You drink too much, you're a little overweight, and you're just a general schlub, which one, take one look at Benedict Cumberbatch, and he's none of those things. He goes to Moscow, meets the guy, Oleg Penkovsky, real dude selling Soviet nuclear secrets to the Brits and the Americans just before the Cuban Missile Crisis. So big deal. Oleg takes a shine to him. He says, this guy's great. He's really bad at this. No one will suspect it. So he says, you need to keep doing this. Fly to Moscow all the time. I'll give you all the intelligence you need. They develop a rapport. They develop a friendship. They meet each other's families, which I thought was the best part personally of the film, much more than the spy trade craft. But it's really a standard, you know, espionage, not quite a thriller, espionage drama, if you will. It's okay. It's not the best spy film I've ever seen, but it's damn sure not the worst. You know, it'll get you done on a cold night, Hannah.
Yeah, it reminded me of Bridge of Spies. It had a very similar vibe, tone. And these spy movies, very often, especially when they're based on true stories, they tend to have a relatively low energy. You know, even though the stakes are incredibly high, you are just kind of watching this drama unfold. And so it's got good performances, though, and it's an interesting story and good. So the characters make it worth watching. So it's not going to be like a Bourne movie. There's no major action going on. I was not aware of, I mean, you know, you hear about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know how we got to the brink of nuclear war with the Soviets and the whole Cold War atmosphere. And so this was really sort of getting part of that story through a very different lens that I don't think I had seen before. And I mean, I love Benedict Cumberbatch, at least in this one. I mean, I just saw him in The Mauritanian, where he had like a Louisiana accent. So I was really happy to hear Benedict Cumberbatch like in his native accent. And it also, I mean, his wife is played by Rachel Brosnahan.
No.
Or is that the other wife?
Rachel Brosnahan is the CIA source handler.
Oh, she's the CIA handler. Right. So she's the CIA girl, but she was very Rachel Brosnahan has had quite a year. I mean, she's sort of taking on, most people know her from Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And between this and the role that she was in, a much larger role in I'm Your Woman a couple months ago, you're seeing just a very different side of her as an actress. And so I was really appreciating what she brings to the table. And, you know, it's just a solid spy drama. And so I think it's worth seeing, especially if you are a fan of that genre.
So you were thinking of Jesse Buckley.
Yes.
Your girl, by the way. You love Jesse Buckley.
I do like Jesse, too.
I don't think you saw her big movie on award season that got nominated in many critics' circles, not for the big, big stuff in Hollywood, but she was in I'm Thinking of Ending Things, Charlie Kaufman's adaptation of that novel. She was wonderful in that. I think I nominated her myself for our DC awards. I had heard of Oleg Penkovsky before. He's always kind of like a cautionary tale, but I'd never heard of Greville Wynne. I did not know his part in it. And I'm glad you brought up Bridge of Spies because, you know, Bridge of Spies is really more, it's not really about spy tradecraft either. It's about the relationship between kind of two opposites, Tom Hanks and Mark Rylance, where it was a switcheroo. He was the Russian in American prison awaiting trial or transfer eventually. Now the Courier is also not necessarily about the spy tradecraft. It's about the relationship between two guys. So yeah, the Bridge of Spies analogy is huge. And the events in this take place just before, if you ever saw 13 Days with Kevin Costner from the early 2000s, you know, this actually juxtaposes very well with that. I think if you watched this right before you watched that, the timelines would be would line up very well.
Well, and I just like how it's really these two guys with a conscience, you know, each coming at the story from a different place, but ultimately just sort of doing what is right for the sake of doing what is right at, you know, at the risk of their lives and their family's lives. And so what I always appreciate about these based on true stories when they're sort of that everyman kind of hero that Benedict Cumberbatch is in this particular film. I really love that reminder that one person taking that kind of a risk for the greater good can truly make a huge difference. And what this film is showing is that these two guys working together really did save the world potentially. And so that's what I really took away from it, along with the relationship factor.
Benedict Cumberbatch didn't necessarily already save the world, but he saved a lot of lives in a better film as Alan Turing in The Imitation Game. So he's just saving people all over the place.
Yeah. Didn't Doctor Strange save some lives somehow too, I think?
Yeah. Oh, that based on a true story, Doctor Strange? Yeah, he saved a couple too. Maybe pretty much everyone who got disappeared. Yeah, he had a hand in that. All right, let's talk about our second based on true events tale, if you will, City of Lies, and it juxtaposes very well with our last week episode. We talked about a documentary on Netflix called Biggie, I Got a Story to Tell, and that was the story of Biggie's early life, childhood on the stoop, first rapping, how he became big. Didn't really talk about the murder. There are other documentaries and other biopics about that. Until this week, City of Lies, which, even though it's coming out 1 week after that documentary, was shot 3 years ago, years ago. It was supposed to be released in August of 2018, and then it got put on the shelf. This is Johnny Depp and Forrest Whitaker telling the story of all the rumors you've heard. The LAPD, officers in the LAPD, were accessories, aided and abetting, planned the murder of Christopher Wallace, aka the notorious B.I.G., and the insane cover-up. Now, I've heard of the rumors. I had always heard, of course, the cops were dirty. They were in on both his murder and Tupac's murder. This was written by a Rolling Stone journalist. He wrote an article first, and he's like, there's so much going on here. He wrote a book, Labyrinth, in L.A., L.A. Labyrinth. And it got put on the shelf. Some people think, some people theorize, some people conspiracy theory. I don't know the truth of this. The LAPD turned the screws on somebody on this movie to say, this makes us look so bad, you can't release this film. Who knows if that's true or not? I don't know. It's a spicy idea to think about. That was back before Johnny Depp did Johnny Depp things in the tabloid. So I thought he was effective in the role as Detective Randall Poole. He took the investigation to heart, and it affected his personal life and destroyed it. It affected his professional life and destroyed it. And now he's all alone in this terrible apartment with stuff all over the wall, string, thumbtacks, the whole thing. And Forrest Whitaker is Jack Jackson, the journalist, whose only role is to draw out information from the past. He's kind of a useless character. He's just there to ping Johnny Depp and make him tell stories. And the script is terrible. The writing is awful. They get in fights for no reason. Like every time Johnny Depp, Detective Poole, tells him like some new information, Forrest Whitaker, he gets so upset. How could you not tell me this before? Well, I'm telling a chronological story here, dude. I was going to get to it. But best part about this movie for me, they actually make the scene. Here's where the cars were. Here's where Biggie was. Here's where the shooter was. I got so much out of that. I was really into that. This is not a good movie. I don't recommend it. But I got a lot out of that part, Hannah.
Yeah, no, and Johnny Depp is Johnny Depp. I think he, I don't know what kind of accent or just speech he's affecting.
He went low and slow.
Yeah, he went very low and slow, very low and slow. and I think that Forrest Whitaker, his role as Jack Jackson is really supposed to be kind of taking the place of the journalist who wrote the book Labyrinth. So I think he's kind of a Randall Sullivan replacement, because the book is really based on the case notes and the investigation of the lead investigator. And so I think that's why that character exists in the way that it does, but it really is not a very well-written screenplay at all. But I do think that Johnny Depp's performance is quite good. And I, coming from my era, to me, to see Johnny Depp as an LAPD detective, when I remember him so well from 21 Jump Street as an LAPD undercover cop, it's kind of like, wow, can you imagine if 30 years from now, how was Tom Hansen's character going to look at the LAPD? So from a nostalgia perspective, I just found a little bit of irony in that particular role. But, you know, this film is very dry, no matter how you slice it. And I think part of that's because these are unsolved murders. And so you don't get closure. There's no real closure, I don't think, in this movie. It's, I'd say it's really more about the Detective Russell Poole character than it is about these murders. And it is a way to just expose this, just connect the dots of this corruption that apparently really was in the LAPD, and the connection that the LAPD, a lot of these officers were moonlighting and were in bed with Death Row Records. And so the connection between Death Row Records and the LAPD, you know, that it was interesting information to get. And I'm glad I saw that documentary last week first, because I think I would have been more lost in the story itself of those two murders and of understanding the rivalry between these rappers, between Tupac and Biggie. And so I think it helps to have some baseline knowledge of the rap war that was going on with these guys, in order to get enough out of watching City of Lies. Otherwise, I still, the same way I just didn't care all that much about the characters in the documentary, I still don't care that much about any of these characters in a drama either.
City of Lies is very effective at making the audience angry. and frustrated. I got mad because you said there's no closure. There's no closure because the LAPD won't let it happen. They keep the investigation open so they can neither talk about it in public nor release any evidence they are holding on to, which clearly implicates officers in the Los Angeles Police Department. Biggie's mom, Valetta Wallace, is in this film. That's her. She shows up. You saw her last week in the documentary, and I was looking at her. I'm like, that's not an actress. That's Valetta Wallace. And it makes the point, she can't sue the city of Los Angeles while the investigation is open, because she would win and they would owe her $1 billion. She would bankrupt the entire city, which is why they say the investigation will never close, because they cannot afford to lose the civil lawsuit once it's proven Officer Daniels and D-Mac were there that night and involved in the murder, which is why, yeah, this is effective at riling me up and it got under my skin. It's just a shame it's so poorly made and it's bad filmmaking and poorly written. And I really hope this is not the final film on this matter. Like, give me a break. I need a 5-year break. Like, give me a breather. I've had a lot of Biggie movies in the last week, but don't let this be the last one. There's got to be a better movie to say on the subject.
Yeah. And I think in some ways though, it really was designed to be a tribute to what Detective Bull was trying to be and trying to do and standing up and you know, trying to just sort of, you get in trouble when you're an officer and you are trying to expose corruption among other officers. And so he became this disgraced detective. And then he did die in 2015. So it's kind of sad that we can't really go back to, you know, to find out more. I think he'd still be on the case. I think he would. I think the idea that you kind of get from watching this is that he was, even when he had been sort of forced out of the department, he was still following. He was still trying to close this case. And he was on it for like 18 years. And I think he'd still be on it and he'd still be pushing for resolution. And so I think what one of the points that the film is sort of making towards the end is that you've lost him. You've lost somebody. We need more like him to step up and to try and make that particular difference.
All right, well, moving on to the documentary section of this episode, the documentary you watched, I didn't finish it, so I'm not going to review it. Operation Varsity Blues. If you recall why Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, Aunt Becky, went to prison was because they paid this guy buku buckazoids to get their children into university. And this is the story, not of a man named Brady, but of how this happened. The quirk is, this is, while it is a documentary, this is not Talking Heads, this is not interviews, this is not A to B to C. This is reenactments. This is Matthew Modine jogging around town on the telephone saying things that were recorded on wiretaps. Hannah, was this the right way to do it? B, did it work?
I don't know. I mean, it worked on some level. I got used to it as the documentary wore on. I don't know why you gave up on it. I actually found it very interesting.
I didn't give up on it. I ran out of time.
Okay. But, you know, it's one of those documentaries. It's on Netflix. And I started watching because I think everybody knows the headlines. They've seen the headlines. They know about Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman. But with this hybrid documentary, is I think how they're calling it, is about the gazillions of other family rich parents, you know, the dozens of other rich parents who got ensnared in this particular investigation on this college admission scandal. You know, because it exposes what this guy, this sleazebag Rick Singer, played by Matthew Modine, he built this entire 20-some-odd year career on manipulating college admissions and getting rich kids into prestige colleges through what he called a side door. And so there's plenty of blame to go around. And I loved what this documentary shows. Is that you can't just blame the parents. You can't, I mean, Rick Singer, I think, is ultimately to blame on the larger scale. But there were so many people complicit from the, you know, the institutions themselves, the colleges, who, you know, are put such pressure on the athletic directors and people to raise money however they can. And so it becomes this money game. And the real losers in all of this that you see throughout watching this documentary, it's the kids. You know, a lot of the kids of these wealthy parents, I mean, I would think that when you're college age, you should be smart enough to realize that some of this stuff might be going on with your parents, that they're buying your way into a particular school or helping somebody take the SATs on your behalf. It really shows that some of the kids might really have not been nearly as aware of what you would think they would be in terms of what their parents were up to. And there is one guy who they intercut, and this is where I'm not so sure the whole device really works of the hybrid. It's dramatic reenactments based on these wiretap conversations, intercut with real footage and some real people. And the former Stanford sailing coach, he's actually in this. The real guy is the only one who actually kind of was willing to participate and showed some real contrition. And so in the end, he wins some sympathy points, I think, by being in this documentary. But you saw the documentary Fire, I believe, about the Is that the festival, that weird festival?
The kind of the fake festival, the fire festival. I did see that festival. And how that just went to crap.
Right. So this is the director of that documentary and the executive producer of the Tiger King stuff. So these guys are veterans of what I would call, you know, exploiting and exploring the you just can't make this stuff up kind of story. And that's what this documentary really is. It's this drama centered around real people and real events that you just kind of are almost sitting there going, I can't believe that all this went on for this long and all these different people. And it makes you hate everything about the admissions process, and you feel terrible for all the kids who fought to get into these prestige schools and were blocked. You know, so it goes to the heart of equity in admissions and standardized testing and flaws and all of that, and whether and just the whole cost of higher education. And so overall, you know, I found it once I got past the whole weirdness of Matthew Modine being in this documentary doing recreations, because nobody else is anybody that you would ever recognize or really think twice about. And so once you sort of are used to him sort of taking the place of Rick Singer, you kind of just sort of let it roll over you a little bit. But it's an interesting documentary, I think, for especially for any for parents who are thinking of trying to pay their way in. And I think what the whole thing with the celebrity angle, this is not really, there's like next to nothing in terms of Lori Loughlin and her husband Massimo and Felicity Huffman in there. It's not about them. It's about that the entire scandal and how it happened. And it really will help you understand beyond the headlines what exactly the scandal was.
Well, I watched a documentary this week, and it's on Hulu. It's called Kid 90, and it's about a woman who made her own documentary. And she actually filmed it herself about 30, 35 years ago, or for a number of years. Hannah, do you remember Punky Brewster?
I do.
I vaguely do. She's about 4 years older than me, but I remember her on television. She was played by a lovely young actress called Soleil Moon Frye. And after Punky Brewster, she picked up a video camera, just kind of filmed her adolescence. And in so doing, she captured not only what it's like to grow up in Hollywood as a child star, but all of her friends were Hollywood child stars. Everybody shows up on these tapes, and I mean everybody. And she brings some of them back for interviews. Hey, do you remember when we did this? Do you remember how you felt? Do you think that, you know, she doesn't necessarily get into, do you think it was right what we did? But the big ones are Mark Paul Gosselaar from, you know, Saved by the Bell. He was Zach Morris. Brian Austin Green from 90210. And bits and pieces of Stephen Dorff, Sarah Gilbert, Michael Rapaport, Jonathan Silverman, Corey Feldman. I mean, you name it. They're in this movie. And it gets a little dicey at times. It gets a little dicey. Soleil name drops who she became a woman with. And I don't think she was of age. And it rhymes with Schmarly Schmeen.
Oh, my God.
So there's that. It's also one of the executive producers is Leonardo DiCaprio, who also shows up very briefly. She knew everybody. So it's it's just kind of a video diary. And, you know, we see interviews of her today. This is her talking to the camera saying, these are the diaries I wrote. This is what I was feeling then. And these are all the videos. And she gets into some heavy adolescent teenage girl business. Remember how small and petite Punky Brewster is? She gets really detailed about a breast reduction surgery she got when she was like 15. She and how Hollywood reacted to her new body. You know, there's nothing she could do about it. And they're like, hey, you know, and how they treated her, this 15-year-old woman. She escapes Hollywood and she goes to, you know, the film school in New York, and she falls in with like a skater punk crew who were in Kids, if you remember that movie, Kids. She just gravitates, somehow attracts very interesting people, films them, and a lot of them have very sad endings, which she covers. You know, it doesn't break a lot of ground, but I was, you know, growing up in the same time frame as she did, I was enraptured. I watched this with my wife, and we were both like, oh, I remember that guy. Whatever happened to that guy? And so it's a nostalgia time capsule sort of documentary.
Well, and I think it's tied to the actual return of Punky Brewster. I think I read that that's coming back. So there's a whole new reboot of Punky with, I believe, Soleil Moonfry is actually now adopts sort of, it's like a replay of the original story. And she now takes in a kid. And so I think that's part of why it's all coming out now. But I don't have Hulu. And so I haven't really, you know, it just hasn't been in front of me to watch. But I remember watching Punky Brewster and enjoying it. It was sort of that same era of like Webster and all of those others. Is Webster in it? Emmanuel Lewis. So now I do feel like that it is something that could be a huge nostalgia trip for my particular age group as well. So if I would say if you have Hulu and you grew up on those shows, then it's probably worth checking out because it sounds a little fun and nostalgic, and certainly if you're going to watch the reboot of Punky, then it's a good reminder too.
Well, on Disney Plus, my 8-year-old and I finished WandaVision like 2 weeks ago, and yeah, you know, we're both big fans. It worked for us. It's quirky. It's crazy. We got a kick out of it. So I told him the other day, hey man, there's Captain America's friends. You don't know them yet, but Falcon and the Winter Soldier, they have a show like Wanda. You know, it's going to be one episode a week and we're going to watch it every week and you're going to get a lot of it. And he looked at me and go, Dad, this is good because I need to learn about this stuff. So Hannah, I know you went ahead and you got a sneak peek and you watched episode 1 of Falcon and the Winter Soldier. What do you think?
You know, it opens and you feel like you're about to watch this big Marvel movie and it makes you so excited. And then you remember that Captain America is gone and Iron Man is gone. And you're just like, oh man, this sucks. So, I do it was okay. I think they tried to do a lot in episode 1. I think it was like 50 minutes long and they're trying to set up what I assume then there's 5 more episodes to come. And it falls somewhere between this like massive blockbuster superhero movie vibe and your binge watching series. And it's a weird line to be walking because it's very strange to just end within an hour and kind of go, there's 5 more. It's like a 6-hour movie. Basically, you are gearing up to watch a 6-hour Falcon and the Winter Soldier movie. And there are, again, I only saw the first episode, and I suspect it will build and get better. So I'm definitely going to keep watching. But it picks up like really right where Endgame left off. where these people have come back after 5 years, where, you know, half of the world had disappeared for 5 years, and then they come back. And so it plays into that, and you just kind of get more family backstory on the Falcon's character, Anthony Mackie. And so, and you've got the real actor, you know, you've got Anthony Mackie back as Sam Wilson, the Falcon. You've got Sebastian Stan playing Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier. So, I mean, you've got Daniel Brühl back as the bad guy. You actually have the movie stars playing in this television series. And it's an interesting dynamic. I'm not sure how I feel about a 6-hour film centered around Bucky and Sam. I just don't know yet. It just, again, it made me miss Steve Rogers and Tony Stark. But it's got the sarcasm, it's got the humor and the action and the heroics, the good over evil, all that stuff. So, you know, I think one was all about the setup, and that hopefully 2 through 6 will really bring it home. So again, not my favorite of the characters of why I adored the Avengers movies, but it's kind of an interesting way to keep the story going.
Well, WandaVision proved that this concept can work. Episodic hero, superhero stories. Speaking of 6-hour movies, are you going to watch the 4-hour and 2-minute re-release of Zack Snyder's Justice League? Remember, in 2017, Justice League came out, Batman, Resurrection of Superman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman. Zack Snyder directed most of that, but he stepped away during filming for personal reasons. No one really knows why, but he stepped away for personal reasons. Joss Whedon, a very famous director who's also been in the news lately, Joss Whedon stepped in and finished the film. And after it premiered, we were all like, eh, that wasn't the best movie I've ever seen. And film Twitter, especially the fanboys, started talking about the Snyder Cut. They always like, we know there's a better version of this movie out there, the Snyder Cut. And they were so loud and so persistent. If you go on HBO Max now, you can watch the 4-hour and 2-minute version of Zack Snyder's Justice League. Hannah, are you going to watch it?
I don't know. I guess if I can watch 6 hours of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, if I just sort of play it that way in my head, maybe I break it up and watch it in 3 parts. I think I was one of the few that was not as brutal towards Justice League as some. I thought it was, you know, I remember enjoying it for what it was. Again, I'm more Marvel than DC Comics in sort of what I, you know, the kind of vibe of the superhero film that I've been liking over the past couple of decades. But it's an interesting concept, but I almost feel like I'd have to rewatch the first one to really even understand where things change. Like, what the difference is.
I think if you had to rewatch anything, it would be Batman versus Superman: Dawn of Justice, where I think Superman dies at the end of that.
Yeah,
that's where you need to go into.
And that's where I find the whole notion so confusing to figure out where you're at in the mythology. And
I remember the big thing, Martha. That's that whole, yeah, you remember that.
I do remember that. But I guess, I don't know. You couldn't find time to finish watching the Operation Varsity Blues documentary. I don't know if I'm going to find 4 hours and 2 minutes in addition to 6 hours for the Falcon. And
well, the 6 hours is cut up. Like, you just watch one weekend of that.
But I know, but we have so much that we still need to see. And so
I'm with you. It's not easy.
It's not easy. So it just depends. And it kind of always falls back to what kind of mood I'm in. And if I just, if I have a chunk of time and I get somebody's code for HBO Max, then maybe, is that what it's on? Or which one's it on?
It is on HBO Max. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, then perhaps I will watch it. So if I do start discussing it, you'll know that I either went over to somebody's house with a mask on or watched it some other way. But are you watching? When are you watching it?
I am going to watch it. I will watch it. I don't know when. I'm not even going to say it's during the next week, but I'm going to watch it. I will get to it. That's not the only film that people are talking about being recut or there's another cut out there. All over film Twitter today, people are saying there is an R and even NC-17 rated version of Mrs. Doubtfire.
An NC? How in the world could you have an NC-17 version?
They say Robin Williams had so many hours of improvisation as Mrs. Doubtfire and her antics back then in 1993. And they had to leave so much of it on the cutting room floor because it was a family film. But now people are saying, hey, this is what humanity needs in our year of COVID 2021. Honor Robin Williams's memory and give us raunchy Doubtfire. Hannah, would you be up for raunchy Doubtfire?
I mean, I'd watch it out of curiosity, but NC-17, I don't see how. Unless, I mean, I don't know what Robin Williams could possibly be doing that could rise this to a level of an NC-17 rating. But, you know, we've seen our share. There are comedians who are, when the camera's, you know, not rolling or when they're doing their ad-libbing, they say some crazy stuff and can be very raunchy. So I do think it's fascinating how you can recut something and turn it into something completely different. So I'd be more curious as to how it would be done. If it's done in the right hands, it can be very funny or it can be really, really bad. So I would say it all depends on who has the power to cut that thing together. And I would go for R. I would not go for completely over the top. I think you want to kind of find some balance to just honor the kind of humor that Robin Williams himself would have appreciated us doing. But I don't think you need to go. I don't think you need to go completely raunchy. I think you still have to. You have to still retain and honor the Mrs. Doubtfire role and what that movie has meant to a lot of people.
It's a very safe answer. Last Sunday, instead of watching movies and documentaries, I sat down and I watched the Grammys, all the Grammys, till like 12:30 in the morning. Those went on very long. So hooray for her, hooray for Taylor Swift, hooray for Beyonce. The one category, it wasn't televised. They only televised a couple of award categories. The rest is just performances.
Hours.
Yeah, it's mostly performances. But one category I looked up because I wanted to see who won was Grammy Award for Best Song Written for Visual Media. That means movie, sometimes television. And the first time I ever did this was 1988. And congratulations, An American Tale, Somewhere Out There.
I love that one.
This year in 2021, No Time to Die, Billie Eilish. First time a song ever won for a movie not yet released. And then I looked at its competition. You got something from Cats. Wow, Cats almost won a Grammy. Onward, Frozen 2, and the one I would have voted for from Harriet, sung by Cynthia Erivo, Stand Up. A banger of a song, much better than No Time to Die.
Wait, this year? For this year?
The Grammys have very interesting timelines of when you can submit things. So
that's weird.
I don't even know if my favorite song from the year, sung by Andra Day from the United States versus Billie Holiday, probably wouldn't be nominated because it's just too recent. So maybe next year. So I compared that to, and those are movies and songs that would never be nominated for an Oscar. So I was like, wait a minute, what got nominated this year for Best Original Song for the Academy Awards? And oh, okay, there it is. That's much more recognizable. The boring songs always get nominated for Oscars. Hear My Voice from Child of the Chicago 7. Snooze. That song from Diane Warren from The Life Ahead. Snooze. Speak Now, Leslie Odom Jr., One Night Miami. Fine. That was fine. Fight for You by her from Judas and the Black Messiah. Fine. And the funny one, they always kind of nominate one funny one that'll never win, which is Husavik from Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga. So good on them for actually nominating that, but it's going to be some lame, it's like something terrible is going to win that category.
I just wanted the
difference between those two award shows.
Yeah. To me, the fact that Cynthia Erivo, that was like really the best song last year.
And it didn't
win.
From
Harriet. And it didn't win. But I mean, I remember, I think I voted, you know, at least in my head on my poll for that one, for Cynthia Erivo. And her performance was probably the strongest live. But so to me, to put a movie that came out that far back and to have the winning song in that category be something from a movie that nobody has seen yet is bizarre.
Maybe it's because it's a Bond film, so you know it's gonna open the film. There's gonna be some action scene cut to the song during the opening credits, and that's where it is. Maybe that's why it happened. Or is it because Billie Eilish just wins Grammys now?
Exactly. You know, that's what she does. Well, and Billie Eilish actually even talked about doing that song in the documentary we just saw about Billie Eilish. And I don't think she was even that thrilled to be doing a Bond song, if I recall. I think the video of that came out already. And so I think it was getting, and that movie's just been pushed so many times. So I think everyone's expectation was that movie was going to be already so far out the door by the time the Grammys rolled around that they probably were just kind of like, that movie didn't come out yet. So I don't know. It's a tough category. You and I like very different songs usually that are nominated. All I can tell you is right now, the freaking song from American Tail is going through my head somewhere out there. And so I can't forgive you for putting that earworm into my head.
Don't rag on Fievel Mouskowitz.
Fievel Mouskowitz,
you know, and the streets are made of cheese. But and there see, are the, no cats.
But that's just it. The idea that I can still immediately, that song, that trigger of somewhere out there, that immediately was recognizable to me and I could start singing it, but I won't. That means it really was deserving. I think when you can go back, you know, decades later and go, I remember that song. I know that song. I can see it in my head.
I can see the mouse.
Then that one deserved to win. So whether or not the new Bond movie is strong enough that we will remember years and years from now, if that movie ever actually makes it into theaters and enough theaters are open and people can go see it.
Well, up to you. Do you want to talk about Oscar nominations or you just want to let it lie?
We can just do a really quick thing. I can't even remember. Was that like a week ago?
Well, I was going to point out diversity. First time two women nominated for Best Director, Chloe Zhao, Emerald Fennell. Could have been three, but the biggest prize tonight, Thomas Vinterberg for another round. Probably took Regina King's spot for One Night Miami.
Which is not right. I had a problem with that one. I also don't think, I've been railing against this for the past several years now, where I still believe they should go back to only having five in the Best Picture category. I think they stretch it to beyond where it should be. And so I just think that it could have been, I think there's eight films in there right now, and I could easily have cut it off at five. And so
I don't have a strong feeling on that either way.
I don't like having eight in that one category. And I also didn't think The Father should be Best Picture category. I think fine giving Anthony Hopkins or Olivia Colman a nod for acting, but I do not think that that is a Best Picture nomination.
First time an Asian American was ever nominated in Best Actor, Steven Yeun. Mm-hmm. First actress born in Korea ever nominated, Yoon and Yunyo Jung for Grandma.
Yeah, love
first
her.
First Muslim actor ever nominated, Riz Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
First Bulgarian ever nominated, Maria Bakalova, Borat, subsequent movie film. My biggest surprise, well, other than Thomas Vinterberg, Lakeith Stanfield for Judas and the Black Messiah. Warner Brothers submitted him for lead, best actor, because Daniel Kaluuya was going to win. Well, probably. Daniel Kaluuya was the Black Messiah. Lakeith Stanfield was Judas. The Oscar voters overruled Warner Brothers, and they nominated both of them for supporting actor. So they're actually against each other. And actually, Leslie Odom Jr. is probably going to beat them both because they split the vote. So it's weird to see the voters overrule the studio on that. Snub, maybe Vinterberg didn't take Regina's spot. Maybe they took Aaron Sorkin's spot. He was not nominated for Trial of Chicago 7. And To Five Bloods.
Yeah.
No Delroy Lindo. No nothing except our boy Terrence Blanchard for best score.
Yeah, and Delroy Lindo to me was the biggest oversight because I was not a huge fan. Like, it took me a long time to actually get around to watching To Five Bloods. But when I did, you know, I was so used to having heard so much about Chadwick Boseman, whose role is very small, relatively speaking, in To Five Bloods. And I just remember thinking, this other guy is really good. And so I felt like that was probably the biggest acting snub that I could, that I saw coming out of that. And for the most part, though, no, I wasn't terribly surprised. And I need to catch up on, I'd say, 4 out of 5 of the foreign films that were nominated. And I'm actually really looking forward to the shorts. I hope we get our usual compilation of all the shorts that have been nominated, because I've actually been hearing some good things about a few of those as well.
Even your favorite one that you get emails about a couple times a day, Hungry Ward.
Oh my gosh. No, that one, I actually, the ones that I get 500 emails about, I'm not inclined to see, but, there are definitely some that, that I always am surprised when we get to see all of those shorts. So hopefully that'll be coming our way. We've got a month before, the Oscars. So until then, I think we're good. And, that'll be a wrap for this edition of the Cinema Clash. Thanks for listening. As always, question, comment, rant, vent to Charlie, shoot us a tweet, visit us at thecinemaclash.com. Till next time, continue to wear the mask, please. Watch your distance, wash those hands, and when it's your turn, take the shot.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.